Welcome, action fans, and thanks for joining us for another edition of All 90s Action All the Time in what is the finale of our Kurt Russell season. I'm one of your hosts, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, we are talking about Soldier. And as always, alongside me to discuss the film, we have screenwriter, one-third of the Bloodhound Picks podcast, and a man who's just learnt to cry, it's Mr. Craig Jaheim.
Podcasters deserve podcasters, sir.
It's good. I wondered which direction you were going to go with those. I just wondered if it was going to be like the kill 'em all line but you went for that one. That's good. I like it.
He only has, like 80 lines on the whole thing, and most of them revolve around something like that.
Yes, that is true. As part of the research, I looked that up, and that is one of the trivia facts, that Kurt Russell only speaks 104 words in the entire film, despite being in 85% of the scenes. Yeah. So, as always, I'll give you a little bit of background detail on the film before we get into it. It was released on October the 23rd, 1998. It was directed by Paul W.S. Anderson, whose notable credits include Mortal Kombat, Event Horizon, and Resident Evil. And this was actually also the last time he was credited as simply just Paul Anderson before he took up the WS, so not to be confused with Paul Thomas Anderson. And I found a very old review of the time of this film from the Chicago Tribune that actually mentions that, of like, it's directed by Paul Anderson's bracket, not the Boogie Nights guy. There we go. The film was also written by David Webb Peoples, whose notable credits include the likes of Unforgiven, 12 Monkeys, and notably Blade Runner, which we'll talk more about. Critically, it is sitting at a rather respectable 6 out of 10 on IMDb, but a season low 13% on Rotten Tomatoes, based on 53 reviews, which is remarkably the lowest score of Paul W.S. Anderson's career. We'll get into more into that as well. It has no Metacritic score and a 2.7 on Letterboxd. Box office-wise, it was a complete disaster, making $14.6 million at the US box office from a $60 million budget, before being released direct-to-video in a number of territories, including right here in the UK, making it the highest budget direct-to-video effort of all time. So, Craig, tell us about your relationship with Soldier.
So Soldier is actually one I don't know. I love, which I know we'll get into more, but I loved especially the kind of 80s and 90s, more action-based, but have the sci-fi elements. So you have, you know, RoboCop, Highlander, whatever it may be, Soldier. So this is one that now I haven't seen probably in a decade, but when I was a kid, I think it was to the point that my parents even got irritated about it, because every time we'd go to the video store or to the rental place, I would usually grab Soldier, and I just, because it was in outer space, it had all the fighting and stuff. So I've seen it a ton. But yeah, this is my first time in a decade, so it was interesting and kind of, especially for the sake of this podcast, going through it and kind of cutting out nostalgia versus just the movie and how does it hold up in itself.
Yeah, right. I mean, I have much less of a relationship with this movie. of the movies that we have covered in this Kurt Russell season, as we discussed on this, like the Stargate episode, that was one I watched as a kid, and I know you weren't on the Backdraft episode, but it's similar that I'd watched that a few times as a kid, and those are the ones I kind of remember. And this one is, it kind of slipped by. I remember I rented this movie in the early 2000s. I watched it once. I kind of forgot it. I remember it being a bit rubbish, but a bit entertaining at the same time. And that's kind of, I had no real memory of it, even less memory of this than the other two that I've only watched the once. The, you know, like, so, like, Tombstone and Escape from LA, I have less memory of this than either of those films. But then Escape from LA, the main thing I remember about that, as I said in that episode, was, like, the basketball scene and the surfing scene nothing else I really remembered. So that's where I'm coming from. But, yeah, it's after watching this movie, it does surprise me, even though it's not a great movie, that this is the lowest, because lowest score of Paul W.S. Anderson's career, because I've seen some of the Resident Evil sequels and, you know, it's weird because like he directed like weird numbers. I've not seen all the Resident Evil sequels. And so like of the ones he directed like 4, 5, and 6 as well as the original. Yeah. And the original's not great either, to be fair. Even though it has some fun moments. And, I definitely remember I saw 4 and that was pretty rubbish. And I don't know. Yeah. I just feel like this film shouldn't be at the bottom of the pile.
Yeah. No, I've seen all of the Resident Evil one. I can't even remember. I know 5 has clone versions or something of the people from the previous movies.
Mm.
Or maybe they're not clone. I don't know. Something happens in that thing. But no, it's kind of the same. I don't think it deserves to be there. But I realized, I guess, watching it, the same with when we talked about Stallone, and obviously Demolition Man is far superior than this, but it's kind of the same thing I had with Judge Dredd, which, you know, obviously, for those listening, you should listen to the Judge Dredd episode, so you'll know what we're talking about. But I think there's so much great world-building elements in this. And there's moments that are like, oh, this is pretty good. And then, but the movie in itself just, it has tonal issues. And then which I know we'll get into.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't live up to the potential that it could, I feel like.
Yeah. Just to go back on our previous point one last time, I just remembered that Paul W.S. Anderson directed Alien vs. Predator, which has a Rotten Tomatoes score of 20%, which, again, like, that is definitely a worse movie than this film.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. I feel, this is kind of his MO, is that like Alien versus Predator, all the source material of that is great. Event Horizon, which is, you know, probably arguably his best, and that I can think of, one of his best movies. But
it's my favorite of his filmography. I have some nostalgia for Mortal Kombat because I first saw it when I was 10. I think Event Horizon is his best movie.
Yeah.
By some distance.
But yeah, it's like everything he does, he's one of those directors where somewhere in that is a really good movie, but he never can follow through with it.
Yeah.
Or great ideas, maybe. I don't know. Something is great that then isn't with his movies.
Yeah. But then, I mean, like, I think this movie has more issues than just Paul W.S. Anderson.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how much they tinkered with David Webb People's script. I mean, obviously, he's a fine script writer. He is, you know, he co-wrote Blade Runner, and you know, he wrote Unforgiven, you know, and I think he also, I can't remember if he just wrote 12 Monkeys or he co-wrote it. But anyway, yeah, I mean, he's obviously a fine screenwriter, but the screenplay for this is not great.
Yeah, that's yeah. I mean, once we get into the kind of major reveal, it is an interesting one, especially with, you know, something like having Blade Runner and Unforgiven under your belt. Not even 12 Monkeys. I mean, all three of those are kind of known for their, well, not necessarily Unforgiven, but, you know, Blade Runner and 12 Monkeys are known for their kind of high concept and being, even though I hate what this term is probably, is, but like an elevated science fiction film.
Yeah, right. Yeah, for sure. And I know what you mean. But I suppose it has come to that time where we should probably get into the plot of this movie. But before we get into the plot of the movie, I do have to give my official spoiler warning. Yes, this film is 23 years old. But still, you gotta give those spoiler warnings or people will complain. We talk about the whole plot of the movie from beginning to end on all these episodes. So you have been warned. If you've not seen Soldier, you want to see Soldier, go watch it, come back, listen to this episode, and you can't moan about it in your reviews or comments. So Craig, tell us how the movie starts.
The movie starts with year zero, which is 1996, and we see babies, well, one specific baby, but, you know, in a hospital, all of these newborns that are being specifically handpicked by some government official, and that's really all we know, and the nurse looks pretty upset that the certain crying baby, which will be known as Todd, is being taken away for something. And then throughout we basically get this, not necessarily a montage, but a series of scenes that then go year by year showing Todd and his, I guess his team or his platoon of children that are being trained into the ultimate soldier. And we get, but Todd's always the one that kind of comes up on top. He's definitely the most detached, he's just the best soldier. And this goes with them having to watch a warthog or just a boar, I think.
Wild boar.
Yeah, a boar being slaughtered by three Doberman pinschers. There's one that deals with them having to build a puzzle. There's one that has a young Wyatt Russell as Todd jogging with his team, and he's up front holding the flag. And then the kid that kind of falls behind is shot and killed. We don't see it, but we can hear it, and none of the other kids are affected by this. And then we kind of move into what there's them doing target practice, and you know, and it's having the figures move back and forth. There's a woman with a baby mannequin thing, and there's hostiles. And there's at one point where the woman and the baby and the hostile comes up right behind her, and Todd does not hesitate. He just blows the woman, the innocent civilian, away to get to the hostile. And then we go into a series of them going through all these different.
Actually, the one thing I do want to mention about that scene is that apparently the studio wanted to have that scene removed because it didn't portray, you know, like Todd in a good light. And you know, they thought like it would turn off audiences for like supporting him later on. So that is one of the scenes that they wanted removed.
And it is, I mean, I understand, but that it works, I think, with the movie, and it gets kind of, I don't know, it's one of those essential ones to get understand how far he is. But then I agree there are moments that we'll get into later on that then kind of counteract it. And yeah, with Gary Busey, with some of the other stuff, which we'll get into. But then we see them going through a series of wars, be it in Russia, on the moon, and so on, and until we get to year 40, where we see, or I think we see him before.
I want to say that montage is pretty cool. It's like the way they kind of weave in and out the kind of various battles, the War of the Six Cities, the Moscow incident, the Battle of the Argentine Moons, and the way they kind of cut that, that's edited together, and the score and all that, you know, like it really works.
Yeah, and I think this going from, you know, watching the movie constantly, haven't seen it in a decade, and then now watching this beginning, I was like, okay, so yeah, it's, I don't know what people were talking about. This is obviously, this is solid. This is, everybody else is wrong. This is a good movie, because yeah, that opening, and I'd say the first, I don't know, what, 15, 20 minutes, when you're dealing with that military kind of element, I think it works really well, and it sets up the story nice. Once, you know, he gets onto the planet, it shifts from there.
I know what you mean. And also, like, I do, like, just briefly interrupt your plot commentary. No. I do want to give the audience something of an insight into the critical reaction for this movie, which was pretty vicious. So I'm going to read the Empire Movie Magazine review of this movie that came out in 1998. And it's by a film critic called Andrew Collins, who actually sometimes I agree with. He's a pretty good film critic. But this is, I do not agree with this, and it's pretty brutal. So this is how it goes. Kurt Russell occupies an unsatisfying position in the Hollywood firmament. A sort of hard Jeff Bridges. He's nobody's favorite actor of all time. That's not true, Andrew. And yet has some solid work behind him. Backdraft, Breakdown, The Thing, The Fox and the Hound. That's a random movie to pick, Andrew, but we'll continue. However, agreeing to star in low-grade filler like Soldier does him no long-term favors. His one consolation is that so few people saw it in American cinemas, and even fewer saw it in the straight-to-video release in the UK. Ditching the bloke-next-door persona for a near-roboticized, near-mute combat ubermensch some 40 years in the future, Russell gets to show off the fruits of his workout regime, but not a lot else. He is Todd 3465, a soldier trained from birth as part of the Adam Project to obey orders and kill without concession. In an opening montage, we see him shoot through a mother and baby. Yeah, we've just described that. We'll move on. But his crack platoon is replaced by a genetically engineered warriors, and Todd is suddenly on the scrap heap. Like, actually, I won't continue because it covers more of the plot that we'll get into in a minute. But basically, otherwise, it just continues in the same vein. Is it like, you know, it goes on, pompous generals, indestructible foes, cute kits, all the stereotypes are here, and Sean Pertwee held over from director Anderson's previous sci-fi bomb, Event Horizon, which got really bad reviews at the time, but has been critically reevaluated, proves yet again that he's the crap one out of the Brit pack. But you can't blame the newbie Pertwee for hopping aboard. But when Mr. Russell was offered it, he should have curtly refused it. That's a review. like I said, I skipped over a bunch of it because I realized it's just giving details that we're going to go over in a minute.
Yeah. But what's funny about him, you know, Andrew saying that, is that it's movies like Soldier that I think have helped sustain Kurt Russell's kind of that cult career status, which he, you know, is kind of where he gets a lot of his work nowadays. So, you know, but, you know, even, you know, Escape from New York, The Thing, obviously all of that too, but.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that because, I mean, this film does have a cult following and some people, are much, I have a much higher opinion. That was a 1-star review, by the way, as you might have noticed. But I have a much higher opinion of this movie than that review, but a much lower opinion of this movie than a lot of people who genuinely love it. And it has a cult following, and some people even consider it to be Kurt's best performance, which I'm not amongst those people, no. But there is definitely a fan base for this movie, and it is still popular amongst Kurt fans 23 years later. So, in defiance of that review.
yeah.
We crack on with the plot.
So, after this is all done, we meet him as he's 40, and obviously he has battle scars. He's worn down. Not really worn down, but he's definitely seen a lot of action. And they're bringing this new general, or is it a general? Jason Isaac? That's the...
He's Colonel Meckham.
Yes.
He's Colonel Meckham, so he's a colonel, yeah.
So he's bringing in to kind of show off his new soldiers, which instead of being, you know, hand-picked and trained, they were genetically modified to be the fastest, strongest, whatever it may be. However, spoiler alert, they are not, weren't trained in intelligence. So they're not the brightest, but they're supposed to be basically the best of the best in terms of physical abilities. And he wants to show them off and switch out the old units, basically, and with these new ones. But the kind of, Gary Busey is not having it. And so he wants to put them through a series of tests to see if they can really handle, you know, what his good soldiers can.
Yeah. And there's something particularly kind of funny about this scene. I don't know I think it's when they're like all like in the gym, like lifting weights, they're all just like pumping iron and like see who can pump iron the hardest, while Captain Church, who's played by Gary Busey, and Colonel Meckham, who is played by Jason Isaac, are like chatting back and forth, and they're just all in the background. So it's just kind of,
Well, and I like the scene that clearly they're good and they work well, but he keeps pushing forward and forward. Like, you don't have enough evidence still.
He keeps it like there's all these kind of things that are like, can he do this? Yeah, they can do this. And it cuts to them doing that. Well, they seem good at that, but can they do this? Yeah, they can do that. They're good at that. Yeah. Well, I don't know about this. What? Can they really? What about their combat level? You know, I've not seen them in combat. It's quite funny. This is kind of weird because Gary Busey is not playing a Busey-like role. He's not like a Mads character. He's like relatively, I mean, it's kind of weird because it's Gary Busey trying to be a straight man. So it comes off weird that he's trying to be the straight man and like this kind of stoical kind of like, leader figure, whatever. But, it's still a different role for the Busey.
Yeah. Because the only thing that that sets apart is his kind of metaphors, which I know you loved, Scott, when we were talking about.
It's out just of the recording. It's the way Gary Busey delivers the lines. So when they're both lined up, with both sets of soldiers are lined up, the old soldiers who are humans who were picked from birth to be super soldiers, and the new soldiers who are like, because as we'll discuss in a minute, this film is apparently, according to Webb's peoples. According to him, this is like a kind of sort of sequel to Blade Runner set in the same universe. So we're presuming the other set of soldiers are replicants when they're all lined up together. Gary Busey, starts going on this rambling thing about like, my father was Was he a mechanic?
He said maintenance.
Yeah. Maintenance. He worked in maintenance. And, you know, he said, if it ain't broke, you don't fix it, you know. And, which is, you know, it's a common enough phrase. But it's just the way he delivers the line. It just makes it seem kind of weird. And, it's also like Jason Isaacs' reactions to like, just like these kind of, these kind of homely metaphors, that he's just like, oh God, you know, he just can't stand it. And there's an even better one later on because it's a much more rambling metaphor.
Well, Jason Isaac, it's funny because so in the future, do you not have that line anymore? If it ain't broke, don't fix it, because he seems like he doesn't know it.
That's true. It seems like it's the first time he heard it. So it seems like it's like such an old fashioned thing that he's not even heard it.
But he's obviously, you know, somebody who doesn't know combat specific. It's, you know, it's made out to be that he's like, he went through the military academy and kind of went that route. So he's never actually seen combat himself. He's just, you know, one of those government officials that are putting men in the meat grinder, basically, to do his bidding. To quote a better...
I know that Jason Isaacs wasn't like a big deal at this time, but this role is very much... as much as Gary Busey's role is very much not a Gary Busey role, this role is very much 100% a Jason Isaac role. Literally, you would write this down as being like military official, weaselly, Jason Isaacs type.
Yeah. And so it gets to the point where, because Busey can't just let it go, they have them run 15 miles, which Todd, or Kurt Russell, he basically has a 20-minute head start, but keeps the same pace. And then what their top genetically modified soldier, replicant, whatever it may be, he takes off, he passes them still, and then, you know, makes it during this kind of marathon back before Todd. And then they want to keep going so that, oh, well, Todd held his place, so that way he can still be, you know, ready to fight more. So they have them climb up these chains, and then...
Yeah, at this point, I've just says, turns in... at this point in my notes, I've just put, turned into gladiators.
Yeah. And so then it's like, oh yeah, my guy can do that too, goes up the chain. And then, okay, well, they could go up their chains, but can they fight still? And then, that becomes, well, that's not fair. Put two more of your old soldiers up, and then have them fight. And so, yeah, then this whole chain battle takes place.
And to be fair, the chain, but like, as much as there's things in this movie that I'm going to shit on, very much the chain battle is badass. I think, you know, this scene totally works.
I think because surprisingly there's this opening, and then the ending has, you know, its action elements. And I think the action works does pretty well. It's just all of the middle chunk, there's elements, and we'll get into it more, that don't necessarily work. But I think the action does surprisingly well in this movie.
Yeah, I would say so, because like, much like you, you know, I was sitting, I was rewatching it, and, you know, I was like, I was really enjoying it. You know, at this point, I'm really enjoying it. I'm like, why have people shadowed in this movie for all these years? Because, you know, this is real fun. Like, you know, you had that battle montage, and now you've got this cool chain fight where they're like jumping between chains, and we got like Kurt Russell and Jason Scott Lee just beating the shit out of each other, and Jason Scott Lee like throwing a couple other dudes off the chains, and you know, it's really well choreographed, and yeah, it's just fun. It just feels like a kind of fun, pulpy sci-fi action movie, and it's like, yeah, okay, I'm on board. And you know, when it's being a kind of pulpy B movie, it's fun, but there is definitely, you know, weaknesses that become apparent not long after this. There was a couple of things I did want to bring up at this stage, because one of the things I found out in the research is the scene of them running had to be filmed right at the very end of filming, because Kurt Russell, very early on in filming, broke his ankle.
Oh, yeah.
So he did all of the scenes where he was lying down first, then all of the scenes where he was sitting, and then all of the scenes where he was walking, and then all of the, when he was doing combat and running. And he broke his ankle, and then he also like injured his right foot when there was like a bit of filming and like a prop like wasn't set up right, and then like fell down on his foot and, it didn't break. But it was certainly something that held him back anyway. So he had two injuries. And the other thing I wanted to highlight was, whatever you can doubt about this movie, you can't doubt Kurt Russell's commitment. Because before this movie, like, he was offered this movie while filming Breakdown. He then didn't take any other film roles for 18 months. So you just trained for this movie. You worked out 3 to 5 hours every day for 18 months to bulk up for this film. And the two things happened because of that. Three things. One, he is ripped as fuck in the movie.
Yeah.
Two, because Paul W.S. Anderson didn't want to just sit around and wait, we got Event Horizon because he filmed it in the interim. And three, they lost most of the locations that they were going to film in because the locations that they had scouted got so badly damaged in a hurricane that hit California that they had to do the majority of the movie on sound stages.
Two of those things are pretty good, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think Paul W.S. Anderson was really unhappy about that the film ended up being shot on sound stages, because they were going to give it this, you know, epic kind of Western in space look, and it was all going to be shot in location. But the locations that they wanted to film in, they just, there was like this kind of El Nino hurricane that, you know, hit Mexico and it damaged and then went on to California, and it's like the sets were kind of wiped out, or the where the locations that they were going to build the sets got, like, it was just they couldn't film there. So I think he was quite upset about that, and I think everybody on board the film was very disappointed that they couldn't do the film the way they wanted to do it.
I think it still looked, you can definitely, I guess, knowing that information now, you can tell the soundstage element, you can kind of feel it, that on this planet, like, it doesn't seem as wide open or as epic as it could have been. But I think, you know, with what they did, the world building at least looks decent enough, I'd say. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just kind of, you know, your standard either post-apocalyptic or whatever world look, where it's just all desert-like and kind of scraps of things put together. But,
I think it's kind of one of the problems in the movie. It is just, it kind of looks a bit generic, of just being kind of like, oh, it's a little bit Star Wars-y. It's a little bit Mad Max-y. It's a little bit, it's got some Blade Runner influences. It's just, I think the look of the movie just feels kind of nabbed from everywhere else. Also, the other thing I want to point out in terms of people being ripped in this movie, Jason Scott Lee put on 20 pounds of muscle for this film and looks freaking massive. I mean, he looks impressive in the likes of Dragon, the Bruce Lee story, Mm-hmm. But he's kind of lean and ripped, whereas this movie, he is just huge.
Yeah. He's almost not, I mean, you can recognize him, but there's elements because, I mean, he is in what is arguably the best Jungle Book adaptation.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's in that one. And then, you know, watching it too, because I liked that Jungle Book when I was a kid. I liked the Bruce Lee movie. I think he did Aladdin film or something, made for TV movie or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I remember like, man, where has he been? Because I remember liking him a lot, but yeah, that movie, rewatching it now, it was almost like he was unrecognizable in a way because he's just so hulking out with it. And you're so used to him being like this kind of, as you were saying, this lean, still fit, but yeah, more lean.
Yeah. It's like he's still very muscular in the Jungle Book and Dragon, the Bruce Lee story. He's still very muscular and he's still got the six pack and everything, but it's that kind of lean muscle. Whereas this is like proper bodybuilder, he looks like The Rock in this movie, and actually one of the things is, I can see why people always think movie stars are bigger than they are, because the way Kurt Russell and Jason Scott Lee are filmed in this movie, it makes them look huge. Like, yeah. I was like, how tall is Jason Scott Lee? So I looked it up. He's like not even 5'10". He's like 5'9.5". And I was like, Jesus Christ, this film makes him look like he's 6'5".
Yeah. Well, that's always surprising because so many of the, I know, Stallone, a bunch of those kind of actors like that are not that, are like 5'8 or 5'9". You know, they're not that tall of people, but you watch the movies and they're just, again, like you were saying, they're giant and massive and whatever it may be, but it's just interesting to kind of always see that, like, these action stars that we've grown up with are kind of on the shorter end of things.
Yeah. Yeah. And even Kurt Russell himself, he's slightly taller, but only slightly taller than Jason Scott Lee. He's like 5'10.5",
Yeah.
So, but I suppose we should truck back on with the plot. So after our episode of American Gladiators, what comes up next?
So, Todd is able to rip out his eye, is it Caleb?
The character's name is Kane. Kane 607 is Jason Scott Lee's character.
So he's able to rip out Kane's right eye, but Kane gets him to push them off and he falls, but he lands on one of the other dead soldiers, but he still looks like he was killed, basically. So to avoid any sort of incident or anything, they just say it was a training accident and to take these bodies as far away as they can be dumped, just to kind of avoid any sort of paperwork. And he says there after he kind of scolds Kane for letting his eye be damaged because now he won't have any depth perception. And, it also kind of shows an early on point where these genetically modified soldiers are kind of just big lumbering dummies. And you'll see it later on when Kurt Russell and Todd is actually fighting them because he's able to kind of use military force and military tactics that they cannot do at all. But yeah, so they get to, these bodies are taken and Todd is finally awake. He wakes up to see right before he's dumped where kind of these unmanned ships dump out just garbage onto this planet that I guess where all of our trash goes in the future. We just dump it all on one planet.
apparently so. The planet is called Arcadia 234.
And since he's awake, he's able to see a few kind of, they look like scavengers or something going through and he follows them from a distance. And at that point, he kind of comes across their their town and is kind of trying to be stealthy and not let himself known. He doesn't really speak or anything, as we've already established. But then the sandstorm basically comes and it blows him down these steps and everything. And based on everything that's happened to him, and he's so injured that he's found by these children. And they decide, these kind of peaceful town people that have been living on this garbage planet, decide that they're going to do the neighborly thing and help him out, even though they know he's a soldier, and they're also worried that he might be some scout to bring, you know, other soldiers and whatever that may have come. Or maybe they would come to rescue them. You know, it doesn't really, they're kind of nervous about it, but also not. Yeah, there's some kind of back and forth whether or not they want to be saved or they don't anymore, which we'll get into in a bit when we're told about it. But yeah, he wakes up in this house.
We should also mention, yes, from the kind of council meeting scene, that there is somebody who really doesn't want him to be in the community. A character called Slade, who's played by an actor called Paul Dillon. And he's definitely not convinced. And this becomes like a kind of running thing in the movie that has quite a funny payoff in the end.
Yeah. And most people might know it well. He's the Irish character in Austin Powers, who always says the Lucky Charm, the whole Lucky Charms joke. In case.
Yes.
Yes.
I think that's probably his biggest role, or is like his most famous role. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I looked him up because all I really saw, most of his other stuff is all, you know, either Law and Order or some sort of kind of television role where he's just been doing like a one episode or two episode type thing. But yeah, it's kind of interesting. Michael Chiklis is in it before, or he was in The Shield, I think.
Apparently, Paul Dillon was in 5 episodes of The Shield, so there we go. There's a connection there.
Yeah, and yeah, everybody else seems pretty, like they just want to help him get on his feet, and it seems like a very peaceful community, which you'll kind of see the contrast when Todd starts getting, kind of coming back too. But he wakes up in this bed, and he's kind of awake, or he's either sleeping with his eyes open, as Connie Nielsen is, you know, checking on him, and that begins their whole staring at each other thing, and the forced romantic relationship that we get to talk about. And I know both of us before recording discussed how it doesn't work, and it just shifts from that opening and what we were kind of discussing of, you know, watching it and going, this is pretty good, it's fun. And then it all just goes away. All the wind gets let out of the bag. All the air gets let out of the balloon, I mean, at this point.
Yeah. So it is just one of those things that anytime this movie, with a couple of exceptions, tries to get like serious or emotional, it just falls flat in its face.
And so is she a member? That's why I couldn't understand. I know her husband, Sean. I always forget his last name.
It's Sean, yeah. Pertwee.
Pertwee. Yeah, I always want to say Pertwith, but yeah, Pertwee. And you know, he's kind of one of the main leaders of the village, or you know, whatever you want to call it. But is she a member of the council as well? Because it talks about we all voted. And later on, but it kind of almost sounds like all the adults have a equal, that's just like this democracy and this kind of very peaceful town where everybody has a vote and everybody, yeah, gets to kind of, they have these town meetings constantly to decide what to do.
Yes. So I don't know, because like it does seem like there is certain senior members. It feels like his character, Mace, is a senior member. And then there's the kind of spokeswoman for the town who gives all the decrees, called Hawkins. Yeah. And so it does seem like there's a couple of them that are that have the most power in the village colony, whatever you want to call it.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was trying to figure out. But then, yeah, when he wakes up, he doesn't officially wake up until he starts hearing raspberries, which, you know, is where kind of the family is having fun. He's giving raspberries to his child. And, and you see Kurt Russell as Todd get up, and that's what wakes him. And then they're apologizing, saying, sorry for waking you. And, you know, this is one of the many shirtless Russell shots we get in that movie.
Mind you, I suppose if you'd been working out for 18 months, 3 to 5 hours a day, you know, I'd want plenty of shirtless moments too.
Yeah, it's probably built into the contract at that point. But yeah, a lot of the movie in between the two kind of major fighting elements, and I know we talked about, you know, before recording, then become like him learning to adapt to this new society, you know, no longer being a soldier as what he, you know, at kind of the first dinner, he tells Slade, who, you know, is trying to basically intimidate him, even though how could he? But <I know. laughs> he tells Slade that he was replaced by a better soldier. And he always ends with sir and everything. So I was replaced by a better soldier, sir. And, you know, that's what we're basically...
Which is the first line of dialogue we hear him say.
Yeah. And so most of the movie in this kind of middle ground is him either with Mace, which is like kind of learning their kind of scavenger life and finding all of the rubble and how you take it back, and also learning about these sandstorms and staying on. And then the other portion is being with kind of the Connie Nielsen and her son, and kind of seeing that emotional side. And they're, you know, he's doing delicate things like planting will turn out to be vegetables or whatever it may be. And that's a lot of it for a while. It feels it's not actually that long, but it feels like it's sitting there. Like, okay, so you're still doing this. And then it even goes to the point to our favorite thing that we talked about before recording is a music montage with music that doesn't fit at all. Just showing all of this.
Yeah. So like, again, something else we kind of discussed off air is, so Todd starts feeling emotions pretty quickly. Like, it seems almost too quick. This is started, by his clear sexual awakening of, fancying, Sandra, Connie Nielsen's character. And this is demonstrated in the most ham-fisted way possible, where Kurt is just, first of all, staring at Connie Nielsen's lovely face, and then scanning downwards, and then we get a slow-mo close-up of Connie Nielsen's breasts in a very thin, very, very thin gauzy t-shirt. She is also clearly wearing no bra. And clearly this was like kind of the ticking the boxes of like, we're marketing this movie towards teenage boys, to that musical montage that we so dearly want to talk about. There's another scene that I did want to quickly mention. And that is, so the whole kind of arc of like Todd's like finding his emotions, kind of, in some ways it kind of goes too quickly in terms of like, oh, suddenly he's feeling things, you know, after being, you know, this super soldier who's repressed his emotions to the point he's practically a Vulcan, you know, all these years, you know, for over 40 years. And also it is just portrayed in the most ham-fisted way. One of the examples of this is when Todd has his first sexual awakening, when he's clearly crushing on Sandra's, Connie Nielsen's character. And there is a scene where she is like, hanging up some stuff, some like curtains or like, I'm not sure. Anyway, so she's just kind of yeah. hanging up, like kind of whitewashing or something. And, she's talking away, to Todd. And then Todd is looking lovingly at her face and then, scans down, towards her kind of breast region and, is just kind of perving on her. And we get a slow-mo close up. Of Connie Nielsen's breast region, and she is wearing the thinnest top in the world, and she is clearly wearing no bra. And this is maybe this is not the point where we realize this is being squarely marketed towards teenage boys, but this is certainly one of the moments where you're like, ah, I see the demographic that Warner Brothers want to capture.
Yeah, and the whole thing just doesn't. It feels awkward, and what we're kind of seeing is most of it is because Kurt Russell doesn't speak that much. Like most of the movie is just them looking weirdly at each other, and then that's it. A lot of the movie in general is like just him staring or other soldiers staring at each other and giving very tiny shifts in their look that would suggest other emotion, but that's about it. Yeah, he deals with the Nathan, who's the child, too. He's kind of learning that Nathan was bit by these snakes that are all over this planet that wouldn't kill somebody like Todd, but could kill somebody like Nathan or Sandra. And it actually, one of the snakes bit Nathan when he was younger, I guess. And, which is why he doesn't speak anymore. So anytime you see him, you have to kill him, and you kind of learn a lot of stuff like that. But no, I'd agree that you watch it, and even there's a point where you see, we'll talk about later on, where you see Todd kind of crying and not realizing what it is. And you think, so for 40 years, you've kind of been this mindless killing machine. And then in a matter of, I mean, you're assuming it's probably been a few weeks or, I think a few months, he's kind of turned into understanding all of these emotions. And, but yeah, it doesn't necessarily, I guess it fits with the character arc that they're trying to make, but it doesn't fit within the movie. And I'd agree with you in that it feels too quick and that it feels too.
And then we have this music montage. Tell us about the music montage, Craig.
Okay. So there's kind of been throughout this whole thing, you're kind of seeing Todd, he's dealing with this emotion, and then finally comes kind of midway through, it's about, well, not mid, but you get 36 minutes, this weird montage of music that I know, Scott, beforehand you were talking about, it almost sounds like an Enya song, but it's not, where you're getting the song and you're seeing basically him with Sandra, Sandra and getting them looking at each other, giving looks, and then you're seeing Mace look at him while he's looking at Todd while Todd's looking at Sandra, and then you're seeing them kind of go back and forth, and he's learning to kind of work within this community, and so, and it doesn't fit at all. Like, I understand what they're trying to do and to pass time quickly, because after that jumps to, like, it's a little bit later, but for some reason it just feels so awkward based on the music and based on kind of all the imagery, because the music up until that point and even after is kind of more military like or it's, you know, whatever it may be, like an, you know, kind of action film that fits with it. But yeah, I don't get that part of it, and it kind of, again, like I already said, it takes the air out of everything.
Yeah, and it's just, it's all presented so cheesily. There's all these kind of slow-mo. To be fair, this movie is 98 minutes long, and I think without all the slow-mo close-ups of various people's faces, it'd probably be about 78 minutes long.
Yeah.
But that aside, it's so cheesy and so kind of, it's just hilarious watching it. And it just seems like something out of like a kind of weird sitcom. It's like Todd the Super Soldier, you know, learns to be a family man. You know, like it's just coming to NBC. I don't.
Yeah. Well, and that's the whole, and the weird part about this is that you see all these reactions between Sandra and between Mace and Mace and Nathan, just the whole family, their whole dynamic. And they're a happy family. Like they're romantic. Mace and Sandra are romantic with each other. Mace is a good father. Like all of these elements that you're kind of like, so Todd's coming in and obviously he's going to be the new kind of father figure. But Mace is still there. Like he's, and he's not like some deadbeat or he's not, you know, whatever. He's still like a decent character, I guess, you know, as much as the script allows him to be.
Yeah. But that, I mean, that's part of the problem in the plot as well, of like certain plot elements are so signposted and so obvious, of like, as soon as Sandra gives Todd that first pervy glance as he's, you know, being brought in wounded, you know, you're like, oh, so Macy's days are numbered. He will not survive the end of this film.
Yeah. Well, and then even, I know we're going to get to it soon. Well, I'll wait to talk about when Mace actually bites it, because it's earlier on than you would think he would deserve almost. And it feels like a kind of afterthought or something where it's like, oh yeah, we still need to get rid of him. Just, yeah. Okay. He's gone. Let's move on with the story. And all the characters, you know, happily move on type of thing.
Yeah. I would say, though, that one of the emotional beats that I think does work, one of the very, very few in the film, maybe one of the only ones, is the scene that comes up not long after this, where the village are having like a Christmas party, everybody's having fun, and there's a scene where Michael Chiklis' character is dressed as Santa, and this causes Todd to have a kind of PTSD flashback, which again is kind of presented rather cheesily and kind of doesn't work. But I think the scene that does work is when Todd leaves the party and then is kind of watching the party going on from the rooftop through the glass of the rooftop. And I think this is one of the emotional beats that does actually land and does make you feel sympathetic for the Todd character.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, again, this is the thing that we talked about earlier and we talked about, you know, off air, but it's one of those elements where if it was more in line with that, instead of trying to do the specific romantic approach between the two of them, I think it would have worked better. Like him just like trying to become a part of a community rather than kind of this love approach. But I know it is the 90s and, you know, it is an action movie in the 90s. So they have to feel the need to shoehorn in a romance any way they can. I do think that scene works. And then, what you kind of end up seeing too is that like Michael Chiklis' character, who is saved by Todd from, you know, the one of the storms earlier on, he's trying to give Todd a scarf that he makes him, and like he's almost at several points he's trying to chat with Todd, but you know, and become buddies with him and thank him for saving his life, but it just doesn't work because of Todd's PTSD, and that comes up, you know, in the next scene. Basically.
Yeah, pretty much. Like Todd is working out. He's like using like, I don't know, like an engine block as like a kind of punching bag. Although it sounds like a punching bag. So it sounds like the engine block is kind of made of leather or something. it's kind of weird. It reacts like a punching bag, but this is supposed to be like, you know, Todd's obviously a super soldier, so he's so super strong and stuff like that. And the kids are all watching him as he punches this kind of engine block. And then Jimmy tries to give him the scarf. Todd has a war flashback, a kind of PTSD flashback of just random killing of people. And then he attacks Jimmy, kind of mistaking him as an enemy troop, and nearly ends up killing him. But at the last minute, the machinery that is about to crush Jimmy's head, he realizes who it is and lets go of him, and Jimmy survives.
Yeah, and then we get kind of this town talking about, you know, that they're all going to sit down and vote to not necessarily banish him, because they're more polite, and they're trying to be polite the whole time about it, of saying, we're not your enemy, we're your friend, and we're going to give you any supplies you need. You just can't be here because your mindset doesn't really fit with our society here. And, there's this moment between Mace and Sandra where she asks him if he's scared about, or if he's afraid of Todd, which he even admits yes, of saying, you know, Todd seems like he could, or I forget, he said something about he could break me in half and he wouldn't feel a thing about doing it. And that's what scares him.
So yes, but like, we should also mention that the final straw is for the community is like in Mason Sandra's house, where their kid, Nathan, sees a snake, and Todd tries to indicate that he should smash the snake with a leather boot, and Nathan doesn't quite pick this up, and so when the snake goes to jump to attack, Todd catches it, but feels like the kid still needs this lesson, so throws the snake back on the ground, and then it's kind of stabbed in the head, by Mace. And, basically Mace feels like, you know, Todd's gone crazy or something. And that's like after the Jimmy incident, and this is what ends up getting, Todd exiled from the colony, even though yes, they do it in this this spokeswoman, Hawkins, does it in this kind of very polite kind of like, we're still your friends, but we just feel like you're too dangerous to be here. Can you please leave?
Yeah, and so that Todd, in that moment, it's like him trying with Nathan, it's him trying to be, I guess, a part of the community as best as he can, of like training Nathan, you know, in one of those situations to be a man type of thing.
Yeah.
Or stand up against, you know, your fear or things like that. And, you know, before that point, you kind of get other nuances where Todd gets hugged by Sandra when he talks about the only emotion he really feels is fear and determination.
Discipline.
Fear and discipline. Yeah. And, you know, and so you have moments like that, and then we go to where he's given, where he goes into exile, and you see him, he's sitting there, and again, his face is all stoic, but there's tears running down his cheeks, and he doesn't understand what's happening. And that's kind of up until that point. Then we get, again, throughout every once in a while, you'll get kind of a flash to what is happening with the military group and kind of the soldiers and everything, where was it that they want to take the new soldiers to these planets that are basically are not inhabited as far as they know, to do like little training exercises or give them easy target to be able to kill, so that these kind of new genetically modified soldiers can start getting their bearings with how to handle themselves in combat. Because even though they're great in terms of strength and speed and all of that, the actual combat element and of war and the, you know, what you need to do, they don't really, I guess, understand that part. But the whole point, during that point, we're kind of made to think, well, that Gary Busey is the compassionate one, because he's like, well, what if there's civilians on these planets? And then them saying, well, then they'll be treated like hostiles. And, you know, it kind of, again, doesn't work necessarily, because you know what happened to the old soldiers you know, and that they were killed if they weren't good enough or things like that. So you're kind of like, well, I mean, you're not really a good guy either.
But yes, just, we are supposed to kind of root for him. And I suppose like it's the same kind of issue slightly apply, you know, kind of applies to Todd as well, which it, I mean, I can kind of understand why, Kurt Russell wanted like the earlier scene of, you know, with the dummy of him shooting through the dummy being in there to show that these kids have been turned into mindless killing machines and stuff like that. But then you see like all these flashbacks to all these war scenes and you see them kill a bunch of innocent civilians and you're kind of like, should we be immediately writing off all of Todd's crimes to be entire? Because they don't present him as an anti-hero. They just present him as a straight up hero. And so there is kind of an issue of there of like, because he's not a kind of anti-hero, he is just like this kind of like fully, we are rooting for this guy as if he's Captain America. And it's kind of like, yeah, but he's killed all these innocent people. It's, there is something a bit troubling about all this.
Yeah. Because, yeah, it's not just once that he, you know, killed a civilian. It shows on several occasions him either shooting through innocent civilians, gunning down groups of civilians. There's a part where he's about to, that it's insinuated that he, you know, kills a child. You know, it's like a series of different times.
Yeah. And I wouldn't entirely have an issue with it if, like, he's, like, first film that kind of came into my head, if he was presented as an anti-hero, like Vin Diesel's character is in, like, the first Pitch Black, you know, the first Riddick movie, Pitch Black. Like, sure, okay, but he's not. He's just a straight up, like, Rambo or something, you know?
Yeah.
Where you're just like, yeah, I'm totally in support of this guy.
Yeah. Well, and then they don't make it as much about, again, that goes to the time length of the movie. And like you were talking about it before of it going too fast, of that you would understand a little bit, maybe more if it was a story about redemption, which it's trying to do, but it doesn't give us enough kind of genuine moments with Todd, or, you know, you don't get to see enough of that change or whatever to think, okay, it's about like this soldier that has done these horrible things now trying to redeem himself after years or whatever, where instead it's like, oh, he's only been there for a couple of weeks and now he's, you know, whatever.
He's fully reformed.
Yeah.
And again, I think like, because so much of it is done so ham-fistedly as well, it's a bit like when he's in exile and then you get that scene of him like curled up with his scarf, crying. And it's like, I mean, I don't know why the use of slow-mo in this movie is crazy. It's like, so we get slow-mo crying and it's just like, yeah, again, I know you're supposed to be making this emotional, but you're just making me kind of laugh.
And so what we get though is that we find out that the villagers were wrong. And not only are we made to believe that, but we're told that specifically that we voted wrong because Mace is laying asleep with Sandra in bed. And then one of those snakes is coming up basically ready to bite him in the neck or whatever as he's sleeping. But the snake is grabbed by Nathan and killed with the boot as Todd was trying to show Nathan earlier, and that's why Mace then is able to tell that, oh, he was just trying to help Nathan overcome this fear of these snakes or whatever it may be. And so he goes out to look for Todd, and then we kind of come across him finding Todd and saying that they were wrong. But during that same time,
Finds him in like 2 seconds. I think Todd walked about 200 meters away from the colony.
Yeah. And it's been insinuated that it's been, I don't know, it feels like it's been at least over a day that he's been gone. Maybe, you know, I thought it might have been a longer period of time or something, but.
At least a couple of days. I would say at least a couple of days. And
So he finds him, and as he's kind of saying that he's sorry, whatever it may be, that then they see a ship flying by, which is not like your normal, these normal kind of garbage dumping ships that come every 20 to 30 days, but it's a manned ship, and he's going to go, you know, basically get their attention, because what we learn earlier on is that all the people living there crashed there many years ago, and they tried to get the attention of these garbage ships, but never could, and so they kind of gave up on being rescued and just decided to live there and make the best of it. And so he's going to get their attention, but Todd stops him and basically says that, you know, we need to just get back, because that isn't going to be a friendly ship. Obviously, Todd doesn't say that, but he gives the look that is made to assume all that information.
Correct, yeah.
And he is right.
No, it's very much not a friendly ship. And like, yeah. 2 seconds later, it attacks, and Mace gets his leg blown off, and Todd tries to patch him up. It is entirely useless. And then he just dies, like, pretty much straight after that. And then, because of course, we get more slow-mo, like a slow-mo close-up into Kurt Russell's face. It's this film's favorite thing to do. And you can tell on his face that revenge is coming.
Yeah, well, and the thing about, which I was going to discuss earlier, but I didn't want to spoil it, with Mace dying is, again, it happens earlier on. You know, it's what, like 50 minutes in or something like that. And, so he dies. He, you know, kind of learns this information, not because Todd tells him, but because Todd gives looks, and he just assumes it himself. But he is like, oh, I've lost too much blood. It's no use. And then it becomes, oh, but well, maybe it was a mistake. They didn't mean to shoot at us. He learns that, oh no, they're coming and they're going to kill everybody. And then he starts kind of almost sobbing that, you know, well, what's going to happen to my wife and to my kid? And then Todd doesn't even give, it's not like it seems like they could have a moment where Todd like gives him some solace, or I don't know, tries to show emotion of being like, don't worry, I won't let anything happen to him, or something. But no, they just let Mace die like that. Like that's
even so. Yeah, like you say, even something simple like, you know, I'll protect them, sir, or something. You know, but nah.
Yeah, Mace just dies, and then so you get this whole thing where they're only going to send in 3 soldiers because they assume that nobody, you know, it's not any trained individuals there. And, you know, he's kind of the colonel is kind of cocky about the whole ordeal. Send in 3 of the soldiers, and the soldiers start laying siege to the whole area. But before that, the spokesperson she's going to talk to them and say, you know, try and get the peace and say that they, you know, they're not hostiles or anything. And she stands up, walks, like, what is it? It gets out of the hole that they're in. They're kind of in this little valley thing. Takes a couple of steps forward and then sees them arm their guns and goes, God help us, and then gets hit with a missile. And then the siege starts. It's
very funny.
Yeah.
It's not the funniest death in the movie. We've not covered the funniest death in the movie, but it's nearly the funniest death in the movie. It's just because it's presented so ridiculously.
Yeah, and that's where, again, like that whole middle bit that we've gone through is kind of this, like, it's sludge to get through. But then once it starts getting back into the action, like, as we've kind of talked about, it feels fun again, or at least, like, okay, like, this is entertaining, this has its elements here, but.
Yeah. It's weird as well, because we're like kind of cutting back and forth, between, you know, the warship and, you know, what's going on in the battle, you know, with the villagers and stuff like that. And there's like a couple of like weird little moments that I thought were quite funny. Like, so just after the council leader is blown up, spectacularly, Hawkins RIP, we cut back to the ship and like, it, you know, like the battle's maybe not going the greatest. And, like Gary Busey's character, Captain Church, is just kind of casually playing solitaire. And just like not really caring about what's going, yeah, okay, I hear what you're saying about the battle, whatever.
Yeah. And he, the whole time, is, keeps being, again, because apparently he's the good guy now, he'll keep kind of making little comments here and there about, you know, they're jumping the gun and they're not really thinking this through, they're getting too cocky, and things like that. And even his... the people that are his subordinates, I guess, they're starting to lean more on the colonel's side. Or it feels like he's, it almost feels like he's a little bit alone in this thinking now.
Yeah. There's also like, I don't know if you also found this confusing, but there's a little scene as well where, the, like, Churchy's like kind of second in command, Sloan, played by KK Dodds, is talking to the old soldiers, because they're thinking about possibly deploying the old soldiers as well, and kind of saying, and Riley salutes and says, you know, because you're obsolete now, oh, you don't even have to salute anymore, which kind of shows that these soldiers are very much being put in the scrap heap. But then there's, again, a slow-mo close-up, but this time a slow-mo close-up of Riley's face. And, yeah. You know, you can see some emotion going on in his face of some sort of sadness or whatever. And then we cut back to the battle that's going on. But because we've had a slow-mo close-up of his face, it looks like we're cutting into a flashback he's having. But then you just realize, no, we're just cutting back to the battle going on.
Yeah, now. It is a weird editing because, yeah. And you obviously see that with Riley, that there's either some sort of crisis of being like, well, if we're not soldiers, then what are we? I guess you're meant to assume.
Yeah, and then, somewhere like that.
Yeah, and because all they want them to do, they're basically more like handymen now in a way, or they're just, their purpose is just to put up the monitors or the, like, the command center. Like, that's what they want them to do instead of go out. They even took away all their weapons. Any sort of weapons those soldiers would have used, Riley and his crew, they don't have any. The only people that are allowed to use the weapons are the new breed, I guess.
Yeah. I guess so. That is, what we're led to assume. But yeah, I just thought I'd brought it up because it confused me. And it took me a second to be like, oh no, this is coming back to just the battle that is going on here, on the waste disposal planet. Yes, I also wanted to talk about, what I thought the most hilarious death in the movie was. You see like a soldier, one of the new super soldier replicant soldiers, he's shooting off, like a minigun, like a, you know, yeah, like okay. One of those big machine gun turkey things. And, I'm sorry, gun fans, I don't have the technical terms. But you know, he's shooting one, in classic action style, Todd crashes through the ceiling and like shoots up that guy and it with a rocket launcher, which is quite a fun thing. You know, like always death by rocket launcher is always quite fun, but it's not as fun as the next soldier he kills, who is like firing onto the kind of building, the sort of like a DIY house that they've made out of, like, I don't know, like the side of an airplane or something. Yeah, it looks like kind of a weird house. He fires a rocket at a propeller that drops down onto the guy, and I just burst out laughing at that. Yeah. It's the way it's done is brilliant.
Because at first it feels like you can't tell if he did it purposefully or if he meant to hit the guy with the rocket, but then it just happened to hit the propeller first. I don't know, but it seems intentional.
It does seem intentional. I feel like he aimed at the propeller. It was like he made that equation in his head of like, if I hit the propeller at this point, then it's going to fall down and absolutely skewer this fella.
Yeah. And so, yeah, now the colonel is kind of a little upset about it. In church, this is where he tells him, well, he gives the other, his daddy used to say, which I can't remember, but.
Oh, no, it's like long and rambling, but then it ends with like, about like, knocking nails into coffins, smashing nails into coffins or something. And, it's really convoluted. And Jason Isaac like loses the will to live like halfway through him saying it. And it's so funny.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It ends with, like if you want, put the nail in the coffin and you have it, just use the hammer and do it. It gets something, And so what he's saying is just call the rest of your men in, wait until it's nighttime, and then just go bombard it from afar. Like it's not the most, but it's like the easiest way, and sometimes the easiest way is the way that you should go about it. And so, Jason Isaac, the colonel, he finally agrees. They pull everybody else back, and this is where we get Todd going in, and he's grabbing all of the kind of weapons that these soldiers left on them. And it goes, it's the big payoff, like with Slade, and Slade coming over and kind of seeing Todd loading up all these weapons, putting all the clips in, cocking them, and then asking if Todd needs any help. And then Todd puts a clip in it's like an Uzi or something. I don't know guns either. But
again, apology gun fans. We don't know. We don't have any knowledge on this.
And then Slade is just kind of like, oh, okay. And then he, backs away. It's basically the...
It's quite a funny scene as well, because like the way Paul Dillon plays it, just the way he says, "You need any help, partner?" Like really optimistically, like I could definitely. And then he just sees Todd's face, and he's like, "No, right, okay, no problem."
Yeah. And during that same point, then we even get Todd talking to Sandra, and her saying the stuff about, her asking about her husband, learning that Mace is dead. She kind of has a couple tears that then go away after that scene. And then, but through it, we learn that she's kind of saying, well, you can train us to help you. And Todd says, well, no, soldiers deserve soldiers, sir. And that she asks what he's going to do. He goes, I'm going to kill them all, sir. And that's kind of the whole thing, that's supposed to be like the really epic moment, that like the fist pumping moment or something of like, oh yeah, he's going to just take them all down by himself. And it surprisingly is, for the most part, is way easier than you'd expect.
Yes, it is way easier than you expect. You're like, oh, these soldiers are dummies. Like, why has nobody got any defense for this? Why was one man doing all this against these apparently super soldiers, which one of them, I know it's the best one, I know Kane's supposed to be the best one, but one of them kicked his ass, and now he's taking on 17 of them, apparently, we are told, and he is just whooping their ass. But I would say, in terms of the badass moment, it is quite an effective badass moment, because we see him tooling up, he's putting guns, he's putting guns away, he's putting the knife in his jacket and stuff, he's putting his, war paint on and all that, like the commando thing, and, it works.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's definitely kind of like the fun 90s action moment. And No, and you kind of end up seeing, so during this, at first they're scouting for, there's a group of them, they're trying to find these hostiles that they think, you know, they think it's probably this whole advanced military system that they have there. That's what they're assuming. They don't know it's just one man and, you know, somebody that is one of their ex-soldiers. But during that same time, there's a crawler, which is manned by Kane, and has, I believe there's four other soldiers with him, and they're heading to go bomb the village or the town, where the others are kind of scouting the or scanning the area and trying to find these hostiles, which is, we kind of get, you know, Todd picking them off one by one, either through hiding in the water and shooting them up, or just hiding along a wall, basically. You know, it's all this stuff that seems like it is, if you were to become a super soldier commando, like, you know, day one of training type of things. Like, oh, maybe we should look behind or up against this wall. Maybe he's camouflaged himself. Like, it's all stuff like that.
Yeah. It is quite fun. Some of them is, yeah. He sets up a snake pit and he throws one of them into the snake pit. I think that's one of those kind of classic action movie moments as well, where there's a scene in the dark. One of the enemies is looking for our hero in the dark. And then we see a flash of light and realize that Todd has been hiding in the shadows. And then he comes out of the shadows and he stabs the guy in the freaking eye.
Yeah. What's interesting is that you get a scene with the first kind of the three-man squad where they're shooting at them and the bullets are just reflecting right off of these guys' armor. And yet Todd is like easily just shooting right through them. He's stabbing right through them. Like, that armor does not have the same strength when it comes to what Todd does to it.
That is true. Oh, also, we should definitely point out that there is a real fun moment where he is controlling a dead soldier with strings. He's set up a dead soldier with two machine guns, and he is controlling that with strings and killing a bunch of soldiers.
And this is where you learn that these genetically modified soldiers are dummies, because this dead soldier is literally just, you know, the strings and the, you know, you pull the string to then pull the trigger, and he kills about three or four of them because they're just like running straight forward towards the bullets. They're not like trying to take cover or anything. They're just like running along towards where the bullets are coming from.
Yes. They're just like, ah, oh, the enemy is attacking. We'll run towards the enemy.
Yeah.
It's great. The movie even seems to be aware of this, because like Captain Church says to Colonel Meckham, maybe you should have made them smart instead of fast.
Yeah, because after that point, so once the bullets run out, he blows up the whole area with the dead soldier. And then what continues is that the whole time he's been kind of hearing the rumbling that we learn of when the sandstorm is about to come earlier on, that it'll kind of give a little rumble. So he locks himself in, but none of these soldiers know about it. So they get, I think, a good four of them just get blown off into wherever, and they're assumed to be dead.
Well, yes. They're all blown away off screen, and we believe they're killed. One is definitely killed because it's in a kind of graveyard, and the graves are kind of blown away by the wind as well. And one of them is fully skewered by a wooden cross that has been laid down as a grave marking.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's one of those fun moments, but there is that part of me too when that happens, where you're like, "Oh man, well that's four people that we don't get to see three, I guess, that we don't get to see a good death for." It's just kind of,
that's true.
Yeah, it goes with them being picked off so easily, and so, yeah, to Crawler 2, he finally, he takes out the rest of those guys. He even drops grenades inside and kills them. And this is, yeah, kind of a point again where we see, Crawler One laying siege.
Oh, we should mention as well that after he blows up the tank, that we get the classic 90s action beat of slow-mo, running from an explosion.
Yeah, and then he jumps off as it's kind of blowing up, which was interesting because is that the same tank that he uses later?
He blows up. I feel like it can't be like not that. I mean, that one does feel very blown up.
It does, but then I know Kane thinks that it's the same crawler or whatever.
Yeah,
but that's why I was confused. I was like, wait a minute, how does he think it's the same crawler if we watched that one blow up from the inside?
I honestly, I'm not. Yeah, I don't know. It's very strange. I believe it's another vehicle, because, I mean, very much we saw that one totally blown up.
Yeah.
You know, he drops the grenades inside, you know, he jumps on, he kills like three guys on top, and then he drops a grenade inside and blows up. It can't be the same one. Oh, that's the other thing that I wanted to, this is one thing that I wanted to know if you noticed as well. Right. So like there is a scene, just coming up now, where Kane in Crawler One is firing on the camp and we get the score, over the, you know, the kind of militaristic score that is kind of throughout the movie, of kind of dun 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 dun, 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 you know, that kind of thing going on there. And then, for a very brief second, just under the score, you hear the very beginning of the Immigrant Song by Led Zeppelin, just like Robert Plant's, and then no more of the song. Is that all they could afford of the song? Why? Just put, I don't understand.
Oh, I did not even notice that part.
It's a very brief moment. Kane is firing on the camp.
Yeah.
And it's like the score is still going on when they play it. You know, they don't even stop the score. You just hear a second, like, I might be imagining it. I don't know, but it does very much feel like you hear the beginning of the Immigrant Song. So listeners, if you want to check that out to make sure I'm not going mad,
that would be
please
fun.
Do that.
I mean, it is one of those movies where you feel like, because, you know, a couple of years later with, it kind of got popular, I think, with The Matrix or whatever, where you put the chorus within the score. You almost feel like that could have been a thing.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. But this isn't the chorus. This is like the first 5 seconds of the song. I don't know. We'll move on.
So while, Kane is firing upon this and you kind of see, I don't know. It's interesting because you almost wonder why are these villagers still just kind of roaming around? They're not held up somewhere or they're not trying to escape because you just see the same kind of corridors or spaces being bombed and people kind of running around in it. And so there you see that point. And then during it, this is also where Church is kind of pushing back a little bit more because, this is before they want to do the planet killer, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. It keeps kind of jumping back and forth, but you have Crawler One sitting there and he's seeing Crawler Two on his radar coming towards him and saying, you know, Crawler Two, go to your 9 o'clock and help me bomb. And he keeps hearing affirmative. And then he'll look at his radar again and he sees that it's still going towards him and saying, Crawler Two, go to your 9 o'clock. And then Crawler Two saying, you know, Todd saying affirmative until the point that he realizes maybe because I guess he's a dummy genetic soldier, that, oh no, like this crawler isn't trying to help me. And then you see Todd is in the crawler and he's hitting over, he hits over a bus that kills two of the soldiers and then he just smashes right into crawler one, which sends, Kane smashes his head into the glass and basically you think he's kind of killed, but sends, the crawler one kind of crashing into the ground and flipping. And yeah, but Kane is not dead yet, even though all the rest of the soldiers are, and he gets up and he is going to, he's like starts taking all these pills and takes this shot to kind of kill the pain. He starts walking around. And then during that time, we're also hearing, again, the military group saying, well, should we use the older soldiers? Well, we shouldn't use them anymore because, or we can't even use them because they don't even have weapons. And all the weapons are out there. And then it becomes the whole element of, well, let's just use this planet killer. We should only need one of them. It's basically a nuke. And so have your men, have those old soldiers go and place it out there. And yeah, and while they're doing that, we kind of get Sandra scouting around to see what's, because she hears stomping. And trying to see, yeah, if it's safe to come out, but she comes across Todd. And Todd's going to try and get them out, but he runs into Kane.
Yeah, and like, this is like a kind of fake-out scare, because like, just before, yeah. When Sandra's doing that, just before the scenes we've seen just previously, was Kane kind of, I don't know, like taking various painkillers and maybe steroids, and then kind of doing a slow-mo badass walk through the rain, and then you think that when somebody grabs Sandra's soldier shoulder, that it's going to be Kane, but no, it's Todd. So classic fake out, and yeah. Then the big fight.
Yeah, and somehow this kind of dry desert planet happens to rain too the one time.
Yeah, to make it more Blade Runner-y looking, maybe. Yeah.
And so, yeah, they're having a fight, and it does, I guess, the classic, what I'm always used to with the classic 90s or 80s action final fights where they seem evenly paired, and then the good guy looks like he's about to lose, and then he kind of gets his comeback and stuff like that. But what's fun with this one is that he does a fake out to Kane to beat him, because he sees that there's a scythe on the ground after he's been hit into, which is a used helicopter, or like a piece of rubble or something. And so he looks at the scythe and makes sure that, I guess, Kane knows that he sees the scythe. So Kane quickly goes, grabs it. But no, Todd never wanted the scythe at all. He wanted the blade from, I guess, the propeller behind him, which he grabs and then pulls down to slice Kane open.
Yeah, and then Kane fights a bit after that, like after his belly's been slashed open. He still manages to get a few good punches in after that, but like... but that he's really on his last legs, and Todd kind of easily defeats him after that, and via kind of chokehold. So like a kind of a very kind of MMA thing, you know, it was a kind of rear naked choke that he sinks in that finally kills him, basically. But there is a couple of kind of beats in the fight that I think are, it's not the best fight I've ever seen, you know, like it's not, I don't think it's a great fight, but I think it's solid. And I think there's a couple of beats in it that are kind of, you know, fist pumping action moments. I think that end bit where he fakes him out is a good fist bumping moment. I think the bit that's clearly made for the trailer where they clash forearms and just kind of stare at each other. Oh, very good. And I also like the drop kick that Jason Scott Lee gets to plant on Kurt Russell right at kind of near the start of the fight.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree that there's elements of it there. It's kind of just a generic fight, but then yeah. There are those fist pumping moments, and that's kind of the same with all of the action moments, I guess, in this. Is that it does play very generic, but you know, it has its good parts.
Yeah. And it feels quite retro, because if you think about like this movie being made in 1998, like a bunch of the ways that Kurt Russell, like Todd, picks off the soldiers kind of feels very much like Commando or Predator. Yeah. And you know, you kind of feel like, yeah, this script was written in the 80s.
Yeah, definitely. And I even felt that watching it this last time. I was thinking about Predator a lot, surprisingly, while watching it.
Yeah, I feel like this movie actually would almost fit if it was made 10 years earlier. Like, if it was made in, like, 88 instead of 98.
Yeah, it probably would have done really well. Well, at least better than.
Yes, I think it would have done better at the box office as well, yeah. If this film came out in 1988 as opposed to 1998, I definitely feel like all the complaints about it seeming really generic and stuff like that wouldn't be as loud, and I just feel like it just would have got a bit better reception. It wouldn't have got a much better critical reception, but I think commercially it would have taken off bigger than it did. I don't think it would have been the massive flop that it was when it came out.
Yeah, because during that time in the late 90s, we were already to the point where, you know, action stars have kind of, as we've seen with our Stallone season, where he's trying to branch out to do something else. But like the big action stars that would go on into the late 90s and then into the early 2000s stopped having that kind of, you know, traditional action star look of like the very macho. I mean, we start getting to more where there's more like martial arts based fighting. And then, you know, where you have the Matrix, and that kind of changed the whole game, but.
Yes. And you start getting that more kind of Hong Kong influenced, fight choreography. So this is kind of the tail end of the kind of traditional American fight choreography.
Yeah. So after this point, the Colonel decides, well, let's just blow it up, and then I don't even want to wait for the old soldiers. We'll just kind of write it all off. And this is where Captain Church is kind of saying, well, wait a minute. There's one thing about losing men. There's the casualties of war, but I'm not just going to let men abandon my men and let them be killed. And he goes to finally stand up and confront, the Colonel, and then Jason Isaac shoots him and then tells the other person command to get on the ship, or to get into the pilot's chair and get ready to take off, which I always, for some reason in my head, because once he shoots him, Gary Busey is instantly dead. And I don't know why, but I felt like Gary Busey lived long enough to see Todd come back, but I guess, yeah, that isn't the case. For some reason in my, yeah, watching it, I was like, wait a minute. Oh, he's supposed to be alive a little bit longer, I felt like. Yeah.
I think it's kind of weird as well, because I think like, much like Macy's death, it kind of happens quite abruptly and it's quite anticlimactic. You know, it would be one thing if like Church and Meckham, you know, got into a fight, like, you know, Busey, like, threw a punch and, like, you know, backed him up against a wall or something, and then he got shot in the gut or something. Like, you feel like this character deserves more than just being, like, he shouts at him, he starts to walk up to him, and then he's just shot and he's just dead. At least, or, you know, he could have been shot and then, you know, still maybe got a punch off or something, you know, like you feel like this character is owed something, but no, he dies a relatively meek death.
Yeah. And because then you also think that the people that are kind of under his command, they instantly like, oh, okay, he's dead. You know, and we're on his side, you know, we're on the Colonel's side now type of thing. But yeah, up until, so right before that point, we're kind of, Riley finds Todd And, you know, and obviously all the old soldiers salute Todd, and they're not going to harm him because, you know, it's his own, it's their own. And so they're basically these military officials, they're about to take off, but they can't, and they hear stomping. And then all of the old soldiers come in, grab them, and start to take them outside. And right in, before they hit the opening, the door, you know, the door opens, and then Todd's there, you know, obviously, which is one of the few, I guess, moments that is kind of supposed to have a comical effect or something. But Jason Isaac is pleading with him, please don't throw us out there because there's the nuke out there and all of that, and don't leave us here. And then he pisses himself.
Yeah.
Todd doesn't have that sort of sympathy, even though he's learned to have emotion. So instead, they're just thrown out there, and the ship takes off while they try and, you know, deactivate the nuke with like 14 seconds left.
And yes, and this is one of the funny scenes that is supposed to be intentionally funny that is funny, where they try to work out the code, and he kind of, she's like, I'm not sure. I can't remember which one is the code. Is it 76? Is it 67? And he just kind of arrogantly is just like, well, I believe I know what it is, and types in the code. And of course it's wrong. And it's a good laugh.
Yeah. But there was a part of me watching it this time where I was like, I wonder if it would have been better if it just showed them. Like if they were just left there because or something where nobody would come back for them and they'd be stuck there for the rest of, you know, basically probably the rest of their lives type of thing. But no, I like that nuke element.
Yeah. It's a pretty good gag.
Yeah. And so there, you see them flying away from the planet. And then all of the surviving citizens, they are kind of, yeah, on the ship as well, which it never shows them get in or anything. They're just all kind of there. And what is it? So Sandra's wrapping up Slade's leg. You see that Michael Chiklis or Jimmy is still alive. That's really in his family, but that's really all you see. I mean, you assume there's probably more. You know that most of the all the children are alive, I think, through it. But yeah, then Nathan walks up to the bridge and finds Todd. And Todd then, again, going with Todd's now become the father figure in this whole kind of romantic relationship thing. He picks up Nathan to show him the stars because now they're going to the Trinity moons, which is where they were supposed to be heading originally, all those the civilians. But then Riley and all the other soldiers give Todd, again, because they all just stare at each other, they give Todd a different type of stare, and he kind of gives them like a, I don't know if it's supposed to be comical or if it's supposed to be what, but it's just kind of like, oh,
I think
yeah,
it's supposed to be comical. The way I read it was like, this look was conveying like, yeah, I hug now.
Yeah.
You know, like, get over it.
And them kind of being like, oh, okay. Huh? And then they go about their thing and you just see them looking at the stars.
Yep. And then cut to credits. End of movie.
Yeah.
And then I mentioned to you before we started recording that the end credit song, like after we get more of the militaristic anthem, you know, and then the end credit song is Power Trip by Monster Magnet. And you're like, where the fuck did this come from? This should not be the end. You know what? I'm a fan of the band Monster Magnet. Seen them live a couple of times. Love the song Power Trip. Does not fit this film.
No, not at all. And it, I don't know. Again, there's some version of this movie that probably wasn't made by Paul W.S. Anderson where it would fit, but not the version he made.
No. Not at all. But I mean, so as we've discussed throughout the episode, that is us now covered Soldier, you know, and that is now us covered Kurt Russell in the 90s. But and if if you do want to give us feedback, if you, you know, agree with us, don't agree with us, please, please do, you know, hit us up on Twitter at 90s all and all that stuff. But, so yeah, the movie in the end, as we've discussed throughout the episode, is completely schizophrenic. Yeah. Pretty much most of the action pretty much works. Nearly all of the emotional family stuff, possible romance stuff, the stuff that is tries to be semi-serious on PTSD, the stuff that seems to be semi-satirical on the brainwashing of soldiers to make them into killing machines, none of that works.
Nope.
which makes it something of a mixed bag of a film, but much better than the review that I read out at the start of this episode.
Yes. No, if it was trying to just do like a more, a not as overtly comical version of Starship Troopers, I think it would have been held up a lot stronger. Because, you know, I think Starship Troopers, even though that didn't go well when it first came out either, I loved that movie and I think it, you know, its satirical elements work even more, just like RoboCop, where it almost, as society has been moving forward, it kind of ages, it becomes more relevant.
Yes, absolutely. And you do feel like those very beginning scenes, particularly when you're seeing the kids who are being shown the wild boar getting killed by a pack of dogs and, you know, like they're all in, and, you know, also at the same time that there's these things coming over loudspeakers that are like, you know, telling them how to be emotionless and how to, you know, deal with all this and then block out on emotions and stuff like that, where you're like, it does clearly seem to be setting up for some sort of Starship Troopers style satire, but maybe like a more serious spin on it. But then that is almost immediately dropped right after the prologue.
Yeah.
But do you have any last final thoughts on Soldier before we head on out and close the book on this season, Craig?
Oddly enough, since I watching it so much as a kid and then rewatching it, it, again, as I said, it works well in those points, as we've kind of talked about. It's not as bad. But it's not as good as it's not as bad as everybody made it out to be, but it's not as good as I remember. And then, my daughter is crying for a second here. Let me. So being a big fan of it when I was a kid and then rewatching it now, as I mentioned in the beginning, it's not as terrible as we talked about. But it's not as good, and the nostalgia has kind of left for it. So this, unless I find it on TV or something like that, this will probably be my last watch of it, I can assume. But, you know, it was nice to kind of revisit it and see what was me being a kid and liking that type of stuff and what was like watching it, I guess, from a more objective view.
Yeah. Absolutely. I can get that. And for me, it was, I probably won't rewatch this movie again, you know, like I said, I think there's parts of it that are really quite rubbish. There's parts of it that kind of work. But I enjoyed rewatching it, just because it was better than my low expectations of it and better than many of the weirdly vicious reviews that were that came out about this movie at the time of release.
Discredit, I don't know, once a reviewer starts, and I know, you know, we both do reviews too for horror or whatever it may be, but once a reviewer starts like kind of doing kind of the attacks like that, I turn it off, or I just kind of disregard it in my mind. I don't know why. Like, okay, like, this isn't a real review. This is just you being petty, or, you know, whatever it may be. Because yeah, there seems to be those, like, you know, there's an appropriate way to review a movie you don't like, and there's, you know, how many do, where it's just kind of becomes...
Yeah, that is for sure true. I think when you're just getting weirdly personal about the actor or even the director, even, you know, some directors that I don't like, you know, like a Michael Bay type or whatever, you know, like, I don't know, like, there's ways and means to go about these things. And I think, some people do it in a particularly, vicious manner that is made just to be, to get more eyeballs on the review, I suppose. Yeah. You know, it's done in a particularly salacious kind of eye-catching way. I don't think that's the way they go about your business, but I suppose that is what draws a lot of readers. So, like, whatever. It's not my style. I don't want to do that. And I don't want to holy shit on things. Just like, I feel like, you know, even these films that, you know, sometimes we're taking knocks on them, you know, like sometimes we're kind of beating them up a bit. I do think that we do go out our way to like talk about the stuff that we like, even in the ones that we really struggle to find things to like in them, much like our Stop or My Mom Will Shoot episode where
I was going to suggest that movie was saying, I think we actually were more polite than we probably even had to be.
Yes. Because I don't, even though I make fun of a lot of these films, I don't like being wholly mean, because I know that even a lot of bad movies, it takes a lot of work to make these films, and a lot of people are involved, and like just to blatantly disregard everything about a film and just shit on it for your own personal amusement and the, you know, presumed amusement of others. I think that's cheap. And you can make fun of things, but you got to do it in a certain way for me. But that's it. We've come to the end of another season, Craig. So before we head on out, do the usual. Hit us up with the old social media details, and then I'll do the same, and then we can close the book on this one. We will do, like last season, we will do Kurt Russell Awards, and there will also be a bonus episode, more of which about in a minute. But first, Craig.
Yes, so I co-host Bloodhound Picks, P-I-X, which you can find on Twitter, Instagram, as all one word, or even as a Facebook page. But we look at kind of older, obscure, or entirely independent horror cinema, and we'll kind of highlight it very, you know, within these kind of 15, 30-minute segments to just highlight them and bring attention to these films. And also throughout that too, we'll do interviews called Industry, where the whole point is to look at either reviewers, filmmakers, it can be artists, whatever, members of kind of the horror community, and just talking to them and talking about what makes kind of working in today's, I guess, working in the modern world and what that's like within the horror community. So that is Bloodhound Picks. Or if you want to look me up personally, again, my name is Craig Drahm, D-R-A-H-E-I-M, and I'm on Twitter or Instagram as, I think it's Craig Drahm on Twitter or Craig.Drahm on Instagram. And yeah, if you want to hear what, or see me retweet a bunch of stuff and not really give my own opinions on things.
Well, it's kind of the same with me.
Yeah.
So, and if you want to check more of me out, if you want to listen to more of me, you can do my other podcast, New Horror Express, where I basically interview indie horror movie directors. And once a month, I also have a spin-off podcast called The Guilty Pleasures Podcast, where I look at Guilty Pleasure Movie, a horror one from the 21st century. And that is monthly. And you can contact me there on Twitter or Facebook. On Twitter, I am at New Horror EXP. My personal Twitter is at ScottMurphy85. As I mentioned, you can also hit up this Twitter at 90sall. And yes, if you enjoyed this show, please do rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And make sure those reviews are 5 stars, because otherwise we upset the almighty algorithm gods, and we don't want to do that. You don't want that on your conscience, do you? No, I didn't think so. So 5 stars, thank you very much. So, like I said, that is all for this season. Please do tune in for our special Kurt Russell Awards, and tune in next week when we will have a bonus episode where we will be looking at 1993's Disney's Three Musketeers. Until then, though, see ya.